Welcome to Flat Chat, the podcast that's like a London bus. You wait a month and a half and then two come along at once. We welcome some different voices to the podcast for this special edition, but the first one will be familiar. I can hear a familiar sigh in my headphones already. He's got a book out just in time for Christmas. If this were a TV chat show, I would be pulling a copy of it off the shelf behind me. The shelf that my other guests will see is what Christian Horner refers to as my partisan bookshelf. Anyhow, let's welcome Mark Gallagher.
Good to be chatting to you again. I can't believe we're going to be talking about my book, The Business of Winning, Insights and Transformation from Formula One to the Boardroom. Is that a good enough plug to start my contribution with?
Yes, and I know for a fact that it's going to give Richard Osman a run for his money at the top of the charts this Christmas.
I sincerely hope so. It's been really interesting to put another book together. I know you're going to talk about the fact that I originally had a version of this book out in 2013, but this latest edition is all about really what has changed in the world of motorsport over the last most of a decade, really, and pretty well every facet of our sport is almost unrecognisable as to where it was back then. So great to have this opportunity.
Indeed. I suppose, in the words of Orange Juice, you've had to rip it up and start again.
That's exactly what I had to do. In fact, when my publisher called me at the beginning of lockdown and said, we would like a new edition of your book, I said, well, it's going to need to be more than just a new edition because everything has changed in Formula One over the last 8 years. We have many new initiatives that we need to talk about. So yeah, it did become a case of ripping up the first book and starting all over again.
Indeed. Well, to paraphrase Cold Cut, doctor in the house, we welcome a doctor onto the podcast for the first time. Dr. Christiana Pache is a member of the FIA's Environmental and Sustainability Commission, where she represents Motorsport UK. She's also the founder of Innovation, I hope I pronounced that right, a sustainability consultancy, and an ambassador for the FIA Girls on Track initiative. And beyond all that, a person with one of the longest stuff I'm doing at the moment entries on LinkedIn I've ever seen. Christiana, welcome, and thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for reading everything from LinkedIn. it's quite a long, I have to say, 25 years in motorsport is a quite a long take, well, as most of the people here.
Well, I hope it's all true, because I know a lot of people fib terribly on LinkedIn.
I used to be the FIA police. I'm not allowed to do something that is not true.
Oh, dear. And in another first for this podcast, also joining us today is a two-time winner of the Monaco Grand Prix, and latterly the co-founder of an award-winning TV production company. He's also the chairman of the W Series and president of the BRDC, someone else who takes a long time to introduce because he's done so much stuff. David Coulthard, welcome.
Thank you very much. My stuff didn't involve, you know, years of study and late nights. You learned fellow members here, you've put in all the hard yards. I've just inherited it all through being good at going around in circles.
David, you've had a slightly different type of late night over the years, I think, from us. Less academia involved.
Yeah, well, a lot of discovery. And I felt I owed it to mankind, and or humankind maybe is the more appropriate expression now, but in my case, mankind. And also being a village boy, you know, I was a curious chap when I started travelling the world.
Yes, because you're from that place in Scotland where you sort of set off towards the ferry from Glasgow way, and then you drive for an hour and you think, I'm nearly there. Then you've driven for 2 hours, you think, I'm nearly there. Drive for 3 hours, ye gods, am I nearly there to see the David Coulthard Museum.
Have you been to the David Coulthard Museum?
I have.
You have? Did you pay to go in?
I drove there from the Jim Clark Rooms in border country, so it was practically midnight by the time I got there. Anyhow, this glib frippery must end. Let's talk about useful stuff rather than madness and strange cupboards full of racing cars in the middle of nowhere. If, you know, the west coast of Scotland can be described as nowhere without triggering many listeners. Many of my guests have in common is that they spend a lot of time speaking to business leaders about the lessons they can learn from motor racing. Sponsorship has played a huge role in greasing the wheels of racing even before you were allowed to put stickers on cars. So I suppose approaching Mark first, what is it about the corporate world that attracts it to Formula One?
Well, I was really thinking about this a great deal while I was writing my book, because DC and I particularly do a lot of work together speaking to corporate clients, and they tell us precisely what it is they're interested in. They're fascinated by the fact that a Formula One team, whilst having this great teamwork that we all hear about, also has a lot of other quite significant things that business leaders find fascinating. First of all, we have to operate within very tight rules and regulations, so it's a world of compliance, and yet we have to not only build a fully compliant car, but we also have to build an innovative car. And these two things can sometimes compete, as we know. So there's a kind of that whole kind of challenge of how do you create a highly innovative product when there's lots of rules and regulations. Then we move on to the fact that it's a sport with now 23 Grand Prix around the world, which effectively are 23 non-negotiable deadlines by which you have to deliver hardware and software upgrades, and really it's a formidable logistics challenge alone, never mind the technical challenge of ensuring that you're competitive each and every weekend. And then you move on to all the technical complexity. And we're going to talk later on in the podcast, I know, about data science, because I've done an interview with Neil Martin, who was one of the foremost data scientists to come into Formula One and really pioneer the use of analytics in race strategy. And so again, in the world of technology and data and connectivity, companies are fascinated with how Formula One uses this connected environment where race strategy decisions are not even made at the racetrack. You have people back at base in Brackley and Milton Keynes and Grove calling the shots real time during a Grand Prix. So you add all of that together, and essentially the world of business is can't stress this enough. World of business is fascinated by Formula One.
David, presumably when you're attending these events, that you have a long queue of people wanting your autograph, but you can also develop or convey winning insights, I imagine.
Well, I think actually that's one of the key things that I can do. And in conjunction with Mark, we've had a lot of fun traveling around the globe and talking to businesses, obviously a little bit less of late, but I'm sure that will take a more familiar look going forward. But, you know, the great thing, and as Mark has already said, there's so many similarities between how the business of Formula One operates and how very successful businesses operate. And I think that what a lot of businesses can learn is just the as Mark mentioned, the non-negotiable deadlines. A lot of people, you'll hear of products, you know, a product launch is coming and it gets delayed and it gets delayed. It doesn't happen in Formula One. You can't delay the launch of your car beyond the start of the season. Everyone is on the grid with their car for the first race of the season because they have to be. So it focuses the mind. And I think there's so many inefficiencies in everyday life that, you know, very obvious ones would be when you're waiting for someone to come and service something in your home and they give you a window of between 8 and 12. You know, our family business is transport. We're given a 30-minute window to get a product from Glasgow to London, central London. And if we miss that window, we could be back of the queue for unloading for the whole day. So you know what? We don't miss the window because it costs time. It costs money. So I think that there's a lot to be said about really focusing people. The insights that Formula One is able to give us real time, whether it's the very exciting display of human, you know, teamwork in the pit stop, which used to be, you know, under 2 seconds. But I think due to a little, you know, FIA clarifications on what was human performance and what wasn't, we're now sadly over 2 seconds, which is still an impressive time. But I think it's important that pit stops remain faster than the acceleration of an all-electric car, because, those magical numbers are things that stick in people's minds.
It's interesting, just looking back at the past sort of 7 or 8 years, the first edition of Mark's soon-to-be best-selling book was published in 2013. And Formula One and motor racing have changed by a massive amount since then. We've had hybrid engines, we've had the discussion around them, we've had the arguments about it, we've had the business of the commercial rights holder thinking it was awful and wanted to go back to V8s and all that madness. And sustainability and diversity are now much higher in the mix as subjects than they were in 2013. You know, it used to be the case, and we wrote about this in GP Racing magazine, that Formula One was run by a very small group of rich old white men, and to some extent it still is. What is it that's changed to enable two issues that had previously been stifled to actually break through? Christiana, your company helps motorsport organisations develop decarbonisation strategies. I don't think 8 or 9 years ago, with the exception of McLaren, many people were trying to do that. I believe you've recently worked with Williams on the zero carbon pathway they announced last month, which just from my reading of it seemed to be a little bit running ahead of the curve in terms of Formula One teams trying to go zero carbon.
Yes, correct. But I have to say, to be honest, the idea of sustainability in motorsport is not new and is not 5 years ago. It's since 2008 that we introduced it. So I don't know if you remember, but there was a big row just before introducing CARES. And I was at the FIA in the technical department then. And the idea of introducing CARES into F1 was actually to start in the path to sustainability through innovation and technology. And the FIA Institute that was established in 2009 was always very keen in dialing sustainability since 2009. So I think was already there, but wasn't mainstream because there were other problems like safety and all the like grassroots of motorsport. So in that way, I think sustainability is not new to the games. It just like was a bit underplayed until very recently, and then of course it's like all come alive. I have to say I've been quite lucky because I was exposed to sustainability since then, since 2008, and I've been doing a PhD on sustainability and strategy management, studying motorsport and the transition and how that should have been implemented since 2015. So that obviously has helped me to understand a bit more on how to talk sustainability with engineers and with motorsport people, that everybody has got very different language. So if you can make it easier for people to understand it, then is how people can actually agree to implement it. And Williams has been a brilliant example. I was already in advanced engineering in 2012 till 2015, and we were doing some amazing stuff in terms of corporate social responsibility then, but they didn't really frame it as a net zero pathway as some other people did then. So for me, it was kind of working with them into this climate positive goal was a bit closing the whole kind of journey that was initiated since then. And definitely, I agree with you, like diversity is another big point for motorsport. And David has done a lot with the W Series as well. But I think everybody knows that there were women in the pit lane a long time ago. I started in 1999 with motorsport, and I wasn't the only one. And I wasn't the older one as well. So it's kind of like there was a lot before me. It's just that I think the woman there and the diversity is not like we always thought we are there for the sport to innovate, so we never made a big fuss until lately because we want more grassroots coming through. And I think the W Series has done a great job with showcasing that and showcase that there are women out there driving, there are women out there engineering and doing all the other stuff.
Yeah, David, you've now had two W Series. After its small interregnum, it came back just as strong. Where do you see it now? Has it sort of achieved all you set out to sort of go for? Or is it a case of where you're thinking that it can do more? For instance, some of the people at the front are the same faces in the first year. Maybe it's time to introduce a bit of new talent.
Well, first of all, I love being in dialogue with intellectuals as yourself when you just introduced me to a new word after a brief interregnum. I've never heard that word. I'm going to assume that's like a sabbatical or a small break.
Yes.
I think you have to get interregnum into your next Channel 4 broadcast. And I want to see the look on Steve Jones's face when you actually use it.
He is very good at educational words, but thank you so much for that one. So it was so distracting, though. I almost got lost in that rather than the question. But I think that W has been a great way to showcase that there are a number of talented women out there in motorsport, which, you know, the main focus internationally is obviously on Formula One and other headline championships. And there are, you know, and there has been success with women in Le Mans and sports cars and what have you. But of course, globally, Formula One is still the biggest platform. So from the initial launch, you know, Catherine Bonmuir, the CEO, brilliant mind, you know, incredibly driven individual, has been, you know, backbone of really pushing W forward and really trying to put on the, let's say, more international map, that motorsport isn't, as you mentioned at the beginning, a sport dominated by, you know, old white males or young white males. And, you know, Lewis is a brilliant example and has been for, you know, some time now, that there is diversity within the sport, but that sadly at the moment hasn't at the highest level involved having a lady race in Formula One. But the only way we're going to do that is by investing in the grassroots, but beyond karting, because karting for me is a brilliant schooling and it's a great stepping stone. But actually, if you look, the home of karting pretty much is Italy, and some of the best drivers in karting are Italian. But we actually don't have many of them making it through to the top level of Formula One, because karting is a particular sport and car racing is another sport. You've got vehicle dynamics involved. You know, a kart is a solid device. You hit a kerb, the whole thing moves. I remember the first time I drove a Formula Ford and I hit the kerb and expected a reaction, and all I saw was my front wheel go about, you know, 12 inches in the air and then come back down again because the suspension was so soft. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, cars and karting doesn't guarantee that you've got the future champion. Otherwise, Formula One would be full of Italians. You know, you need to be able to use that as a development platform, and then once you get to cars, really make sure that they're being schooled and developed in the right way there. So what I think W Series does is put at middle stepping stone of the staircase from entering cars to Formula One, an aspirational, you know, faces in the various drivers that are involved, but equally a championship supported by the FIA, supported by Formula One, that shows that you can be a professional. Because I think that becomes the big question when you've got some brilliant, you know, young girls in karting, when they get to an age when it's the next step and the next financial investment, their families go, well, there's no history of, you know, really sustained success for women in motorsport as professionals. So why would we invest the money? Whereas clearly there's thousands of examples of young boys that have gone on to be successful men in racing. So we need to change that. And you've got to change it from top and bottom. So I think the W has really put a lot of the current women that are prepared to come and enter the championship, because some weren't, because they felt it was some kind of segregation, I don't see any issues in other sports, you know, whether it be tennis or football or other sports. I don't see anyone really putting that up as, I'm not going to compete against my equals at this time because, you know, they happen to be from the same gender. I think what it does do is really create a sustainable base for the future to inspire the next generation and to showcase the ones that are there. And if they're good enough, you know what will happen. Nature will take its course and they'll find the highest level they can race at. If they're merely good, well, elite sport is not about finding good, it's about finding exceptional. And there's thousands of young men that weren't good enough, and there'll be thousands of young women that aren't good enough, but there'll be one or two or more that are exceptional. And we just need to give it time to find who they are.
I'm going to jump in, DC. How would you say, because we've been talking about the world of business, you've created the most extraordinary product. You've got this W Series formula that's been created out of nothing over the last 3 years. and is now supporting Formula One Grand Prix. And yet the level of commercial support that the girls themselves are able to bring, and of course W Series is attracting, still feels like it hasn't quite been unlocked. You've had some great support. I'm sure you'll mention the companies that have supported W Series. But where is the block, given that so many companies, including many of the big sponsors involved with Formula One, talk about the importance of diversity and inclusion, and yet you've created a product that's sitting there ready to be taken, and there seems to have been some kind of a reluctance to jump on and make the most of something that, quite honestly, costs significantly less than Formula One?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And if you partner with W Series, you know, as and when we have all of the full audiences at Grand Prix, you've got, you know, more, you know, 800,000 to 900,000, possibly more, depending on the growth of Formula One, of live audience. That makes W Series the most publicly viewed women's sport in the world. And then you've also got a TV audience on top of that. You know, things like Wimbledon, which is a huge television sport, you've only got, a couple of thousand people in center court. So, you know, what I'm trying to get across is we have a real opportunity, and thanks to the support of the FIA president, Jean Todt, less so someone else in a significant role there who isn't a supportive of W. But anyway, absolutely, there's many different ways to cut the cake, and there's many different ways to support women in motorsport. I take the view any way of supporting is good. Some people take the view of it's not my way, that's bad, which is a very small-minded approach to life, I feel. But anyway, the important thing is that we have really now established it with the support of Liberty, the owners of Formula One, at 8 Grand Prix. And now I think a lot of those companies that, as you say, have their committees and departments, really just to show that they're doing something rather than because they're actually doing something. And we've got companies like Heineken, like Puma and various others who actually are putting their money where their mouth is, and they're supporting a championship like W. So I think it will just have taken this time for the penny to drop, for people to really understand what it is. But it's one thing talking about what the actual platform is and how the formula works, but when you've got it on the undercard to Formula One at these amazing Grand Prix, people then absolutely understand it's real.
And can I ask Christiana a question? Because obviously you sit on you're an ambassador for the FIA Girls on Track initiative. And I just wondered what your thoughts are, because of course there was a lot of debate when W Series was created about, is segregation the right way to go? And of course the FIA, working with Ferrari, the Ferrari Academy, has a different approach, which is essentially to try and find women that they can feed into the mainstream Ferrari Driver Academy. Is it a question of one or the other, or do you think both together are actually a good way of approaching it?
So, Mark, I think David knows that. When W Series was created, I was very against it. And I remember having a conversation with David at the Extreme Eek presentation ages ago about why are you doing that? Because I was very much like, we compete on equal ground with boys, so like as engineer, as driver, so that's where we should be. But actually, having seen the progress and how W Series has handled and what they have done in the last 2 years and 3 years, I think it's a real good platform. And I think there is not either or, should be both like solution, both like what the Ferrari Academy is trying to do and what W Series is trying to do. They're giving girls times at the track with the cars and exposure, and that is fantastic. And I know that is not everybody's cup of tea, having just girl racing, and it's not segregation as we will have a championship that is just all girls through the ranks, but it's giving them the time at the track to do so. So I was always very much like, you have to go there in merits, you have to fight against the men. But then actually, when you see what they have created and the exposure that these girls had, and also the commercial interest from some of the sponsors for these girls, I think it's viable both ways. And we have to admit that is a very good exposure for trying to build the base of the pyramid. That is what we're missing at the moment. We don't have a large enough base of the pyramid with lots of women competing. And once that is large enough, then we can find the top of that as well.
I'm seeing definitely more young girls at the kart track. You know, I go to the kart circuits in the UK with our son, and you know, when I was racing karts, which is obviously a long time ago, there was maybe one in a particular generation, but there's, you know, several young girls in karting and competitive and doing well, and some of them you'll know from Girls on Track, and I'm getting to know them, and you know, it's great for me to see that they're looking at W and seeing, you know, in the case of Jamie Chadwick, you know, she's won $1 million in the last 3 years. That money is entirely up to her to do with what she wants. She can take it to the casino, or she can invest it in her career. You know, we don't have any control over that. You know, some people would like to try and control it and say, well, they have to spend it in Formula 3. Well, how about people do what they want to do? Yeah. And, yeah. And you know, I think that she's won that on merit. And I think it's a perfect example that what is possible if you've got talent and commitment. And it's part of a stepping stone to other things.
And I think, Mark, as well, we need to remember, so Girls on Track is not just about racing driver, it's about every single aspect of motorsport. So we go now to school with the Girls on Track to do STEM activity and teach them and inspire them into engineering and coding, in presenting, in other discipline. And then there was a point when it was there to be different, and then it became Girls on Track, where everybody was saying, actually, you go into school and you only doing this with girls. So why are you segregating the girls from the boys? Also, the boys should have exposure in karting and do the event about coding. And you think, well, I can do a mixed event, but then the little girls will have peer pressure from the boys, so they will not perform in the same way. It's only one day that they've got a few hours to find out what motorsport is like. So why do I want to have a mixed audience? And we have seen in the years, I think we're starting with that to be different 2016 to do the activity in school for engineering. And we have seen in the years some of that girls going to secondary school doing A-level with the science, maths, and some of them are now engineering at Loughborough. One of them is having an internship in Mercedes High Performance Powertrain next year. So it's a good thing to see the progression in all the sector, not just drivers, but as well engineering and other.
In fact, I quite often, when I'm doing corporate events, I'm asked about, I mean, I think under FAQs, one is, why is there not a woman racing in Formula One? And then I start to explain about the proliferation of female talent across teams in all the functions, all the disciplines, all the different roles. And I think I'm right in saying that one of Lewis Hamilton's race strategists back at Brackley is a girl by the name of Sarah. And I was recently asked at a conference, you know, who do you think is going to win? Is it going to be Max or is it going to be Lewis? And I said, well, actually, the bigger question is it going to be Hannah in Milton Keynes or Sarah in Brackley? Because actually, it's the strategists who are crunching the numbers and relaying the big picture of what's actually happening in the race back to the leadership team at the racetrack and saying, OK, Max needs to stop on the next lap or Lewis needs to cover off what's just happened. And it's great when you get the audience reaction, because most people outside of Formula One and certainly outside of motorsport have no idea of the complexity of how decisions are made and the people involved in it. And so your point is exactly right. For the men and women at all levels of the sport, there is phenomenal opportunity far beyond what you simply see on television.
I was just going to conclude on that before I ask Mark a question, if I may, about his book, his soon-to-be best-selling book. Is the thing I love about sport is it's about, are you good enough for the role, rather than what age you are, which nationality you are, whether you're male, whether you're female. It's always been a very open, not necessarily as many women coming into the sport, which is now going to change because of everything that is happening. But those who have made that choice at various levels over various periods in the history of the sport, if they were good enough, they've been the top in their various roles. And no one questions it, because we just want the best team of people. Anyway, tell me about your book, Mark. So how do you go about completely tearing up what you had, you know, delivered as an award-winning book several years ago? And, you know, I had to beg to do the foreword because I was so impressed with the first one. So thank you for allowing me to do the foreword to this one. But really, share with us, what's the inspiration?
Actually, the inspiration comes completely from the work that you and I do, because companies around the world actually tell us what they're interested in. They're interested in knowing, why has Toto Wolff managed to lead a team to championship success every year since 2014? Is it because Mercedes-Benz have a bigger factory, a bigger budget? Are they smarter people than everyone else? Is James Allison a genius? Is Toto Wolff a great boss? What is it? So people want to know, how do you sustain success from a leadership point of view? People want to know about safety. I mean, I do a lot of work with companies involved in highly dangerous, risky industries, oil and gas industry being one of them. Spoke at an oil and gas conference in September, and they asked me simply to explain to them how Romain Grosjean walked away from the accident that he had in Bahrain last year. And then they also wanted to know, why did Jules Bianchi lose his life in Suzuka in 2014, or as a result of the accident in Suzuka? So what are the learnings from motorsport about these very high profile incidents? And I was presenting alongside someone who had lived in Grenfell Tower and who is a safety expert, and she was talking about the Grenfell disaster and what they're learning in the construction industry in the UK and Europe about that. And then there was a presentation from someone who'd worked on the NASA program, which involved the shuttle disaster, Challenger disaster, and so on and so forth. It was a day of the oil and gas industry looking outside of itself to find out, what can we learn about better managing risk, making sure people go home safely to their families at the end of the day. And so effectively, every chapter of the book has written itself, because that's what clients have said, here's an area that we're really interested in. So in many respects, it's just a question of me pulling together the strands of lots of different areas of the world of motorsport that perhaps the four of us slightly take for granted because we're so close to it. But to the world at large, they're fascinated to know how we tackle these subjects.
It's like a greatest hits collection, is what you're
exactly
saying.
Exactly, it is. It's a greatest hits. It's Mark's greatest hits, exactly. Well, one of the things that I should probably turn to is that as part of this podcast, I undertook an interview with Neil Martin. And we're going to talk about data science just for a few moments, because for those of you who don't know Neil Martin, he's formerly head of race strategy at McLaren. He worked with UDC. He then moved to Red Bull Racing and then laterally Ferrari. He now runs his own company, and his company provides sort of data analytics and data science solutions into wider industry as well as motorsport companies. And I started by asking Neil about recent examples of drivers in Formula One who we hear on the radio debating and indeed arguing race strategy with their engineers during a Grand Prix.
So, Neil, it's really great to have you join us on the podcast today. And we all talk in Formula One about strategy. Last couple of races, we've seen big upsets with Lando Norris and Lewis Hamilton. What's your view whenever, you as a strategist, someone who has spent your life trying to optimize strategy, what's your opinion when you see, Lando Norris decide to stay out in those conditions as they were in Russia, and then Lewis Hamilton, again, debating on strategy with his team in Turkey?
Well, for me, Mark, the driver is literally just the most expensive sensor on the car. They are really good at giving feedback, but they are too close to the coalface to be able to see the bigger picture. The one time for me when they have the choice and they should make the decision is if it is too dangerous to stay on track on the tyres they are on. In that case, they can call themselves in. Otherwise, they are far more use reporting back the conditions live during the race.
So do you sit watching Formula One today feeling massively frustrated when you see drivers of Lando and Lewis's capability effectively kind of dictating what's happening at a moment when presumably the strategists do have the big picture of what should be taking place?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, there are risk events that may or may not occur. So if one driver not related to yourself spins off, there might be a safety car. And had you had pitted, you'd have looked like a hero. So there's no one right answer. And that's what makes it an issue for everyone, because everyone's got an opinion on it. And when you're going around the track at high speed, saying we'll get back to you can be mighty frustrating for a driver.
Now, in my book, I I quote you in terms of, you know, your background, your experience as a data scientist working in Formula One. And there's a quote which you kindly gave me, and you talk about Formula One as being the sort of the ultimate meritocracy. Just explain a little bit more about the appeal for you as a data scientist working in Formula One.
Yeah, so if the top teams have fairly equal resources and fairly equal decisions, whoever does the best job ultimately wins. So if you've got bright people in both teams, we're in a situation where whoever outperforms in efficiencies or any area can actually get the competitive advantage.
Tell me, how the heck do you end up becoming a strategist in Formula One? What was the path that took Neil Martin to the top of our sport?
Fairly unique. There were no graduate programs when I joined. I literally approached McLaren International, as it was, and said, I've seen there's refueling in the sport. Can I have a go at modeling it mathematically? And then within a few months after they gave me a project, I was able to outperform some of the engineers who were doing it for years.
Now, was it you that was outperforming them, or was it your software that was outperforming them?
That's very true, actually. It was, in fact, the analytics and the software, because you could take out human bias, which if a decision maker had got burned in the past, they would put too much weight on it going forward into the future. And the numbers were able to mitigate that bias.
So, so is this another way of saying that too many engineers follow gut instinct and past experiences rather than looking at the raw zeros and ones of the data?
Probably back in the late 80s, early 90s, I'd agree with that. But as time has gone on, then the numbers are like the casino, the house always wins overall.
Now, you worked with McLaren, then with Red Bull Racing, and laterally with Ferrari as head of strategy. Give us a breakthrough moment. Give us a story from each of those, because I know you had great success at McLaren, which is one of the reasons Red Bull wanted you to come and join them. And then similarly at Ferrari, you went on to achieve further success. So give us some storytelling around Neil Martin, data scientist working at McLaren, Red Bull and Ferrari.
Okay. I think 2003, the start of the season, all of the rules changed. And when all of the rules change, that's where there's a great opportunity for when you've got better models to actually make an impact. And we were modeling the race because they changed the qualifying rules. So all of a sudden, you carried fuel into qualifying that you then took into the race. So what that meant was that the teams at the back could take out fuel and qualify higher up, but it was a poor race strategy, but great for headlines on the Saturday night papers. And what we were able to do was model all these new variables and the likelihood of a safety car. And what we noticed was that if you couldn't qualify on the front two rows with the two-stop strategy, you should probably pit on lap one of the race. Now, for all the listeners who do Formula One, that's not a great strategy to pit on lap one of the race under normal circumstances. But the results were so strong coming out of the simulation. About a week before the race, I was taken in to see Ron Dennis, where I had to explain this phenomenon of potentially pitting on lap one.
That sounds like a fun meeting.
It was. He sat there, he listened, he engaged. And then he said, I understand it, I get it, but you won't do this with my cars, will you, Neil? In the end, we did exactly that. We qualified in 11th and 14th, I think it was, which gave us something called asymmetric risk, where there's a lot more upside than downside because we were already out of the points. So we pitted Kimi Raikkonen on the formation lap and DC on lap three of the race. And from 11th and 14th, we finished first and third.
Please tell me that Ron Dennis thanked you afterwards.
Oh yes, of course. in a true style.
Good. And then when you went off to Red Bull, of course, you were joining a team which, you know, well you know, when Red Bull, I mean, people forget when Red Bull came into Formula One and bought Jaguar, and not many people gave them much of a chance of being successful. So suddenly you find yourself going from McLaren with all the heritage and championship history of McLaren into Red Bull. So talk us through a breakthrough moment at Christian Horner's team.
Yeah, for me, that was half the challenge, is that could we repeat the success going from a well-oiled machine to something that was embryonic with a lot of promise. The strategy that actually sticks in my mind more than ever was Red Bull's first victory as Red Bull Racing, as opposed to Toro Rosso. And it was a 1-2 finish. And we were in Shanghai. And again, it was when there was refueling in the car. And we'd qualified quite high up. And what was happening was it was horrible weather conditions. So the race started behind the safety car. And as everyone orbited behind the safety car, someone had the bright idea in another team of saying, let's use this opportunity for a free pit stop. So they filled up with fuel and went to the back. And that then started a domino effect of someone saying, well, if I don't pit now, I'm going to be right at the back. However, at Red Bull, we looked at the data and we said, do you know what? Let everyone else pit fill up with fuel, because we will then float to 1-2 in the race. Even though we've got less fuel in the car, those few laps at the front will allow us to pull away. And because the conditions are so bad, the spray will mean that everyone who's refueled will be heavy, they'll be at the back, and we will be able to pull away, pit, and then control and dominate the race. And for Red Bull to finish 1-2 at that race, I remember it vividly, because after we won it, and it was 1-2, we ran down to the podium for the first time ever, and almost unprecedented in Formula One, all the other mechanics came out of the garage and actually clapped us as we went down to the podium.
Oh, now, that's a nice moment.
I've never experienced that before. It was phenomenal.
And then really from one end of the spectrum to another. So going from this kind of disruptive Red Bull organization that's come into Formula One, then going to the team with the most heritage and experience, Ferrari, working with Fernando Alonso. Just talk to us about that, and maybe another counterintuitive strategy that was deployed to help win a race.
Yeah, Fernando's a great character, and he when he feels loves, can perform like no other. He is, I colloquially, he is the Terminator with the steering wheel. He just never gives up. He is so dogged. He is so quick. He can drag a car around a track beyond its capability. So that's fairly impressive. Probably the cheekiest strategy we ever did was in 2012 in Austin. We were trailing to Red Bull at the time, and we needed a podium to actually stay in the championship. Now, this was problematic because Fernando qualified somewhere like ninth in the race. Now, that was so bad because on average, through strategy, we could get him three positions, but he needed a podium. And the other thing we noticed at Austin, which was atypical, was Fernando's qualifying was so bad that Felipe Massa was ahead of him, which for those of you who are deep into F1, that's a rare event that Fernando gets out qualified. And we noticed when we analyzed the data that there was a slippy side to the grid and a grippy side, because it was the first time we went to Austin. So we looked at the simulations, and the simulation said we needed to be fourth around the first corner to have a chance of getting to the podium. Now, the only way we could do that was by giving Felipe a penalty, because Felipe qualified ahead of Fernando. So by giving him a five place grid penalty, would then put Fernando on the grippy side of the grid. So Fernando spent the whole formation lap warming up his entire car, his tires, his brakes and everything. And he was optimized for about the first 400 meters to put it in fourth position. He duly delivered and through strategy was able to finish third, which kept us in the championship. And we didn't forget Felipe either, because he finished just one position behind, because he had also gone from the slippy side of the grid, even though five places back, to the grippy side. So it enabled him to gain off the start as well.
Amazing. Who had the job of telling Felipe Massa, we're giving you a penalty from inside our team?
I actually don't know. It would probably been Stefano Domenicali or Pat Fry. I just remember the phone call from Maranello to Pat. I picked up the phone. I dialed him. I'm like, Pat, I'm being serious. This is not a joke. We need to give Felipe a penalty. and when he got his head around it, he then went to the FIA and said, you know, we've got this opportunity, but we don't want to bring the sport into disrepute. How do we go about doing this? Because all we have to do is start the car with no fuel and then we get a grid penalty, but it was a huge engine bill as well. But yes, there were logistical issues as well, not to be disrespectful to the sport.
Now, final question, bit of a trick question for you, Neil. Given all your experience as a data scientist working in Formula One and running strategy for three of the most successful teams in the sport's history, do you like working with younger or older drivers? If you were given the choice of a Fernando Alonso, a Lewis Hamilton, a Sebastian Vettel, or a Lando Norris, a Charles Leclerc, or a George Russell, which would you opt for?
That's really tricky because I've worked for most of my career with the older drivers. So you get a feel with them because you've grown up with them, so to speak. When the younger drivers who come in are massively quick. However, they do have some things to learn, which the wise old heads know a lot better. So to be honest, either. As long as they're a quick driver, I'll take them.
Okay, well, as one wise old head to another, thank you so much, Neil, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So, DC, Neil Martin describes a Formula One driver as a very expensive sensor that simply provides data. Sorry to reduce your vast capabilities to that of a sensor. What's your take on that? Is that very true these days?
Well, actually, I think that's an upgrade from when I entered Formula One. Drivers were seen as light bulbs. You know, when you started to dim in performance, they simply replaced you with another one. So I'll take an expensive sensor. Neil is, a brilliant mind and sees things that, you know, even if he started explaining them to me now for the rest of my life, I wouldn't quite get my head around. But, you know, that again is a great example of the sort of minds that come, the men and women that are involved in the backstory of the creation and the delivery of a Grand Prix car for two individuals to go racing around in circles. And I think it's that relentless pursuit, isn't it, of performance and using technologies. And the thing I love about Formula One is creating new technology, finding a word for something that we didn't even know we needed. And so many times in my career, there'd be a discussion with engineers and I'd be trying to articulate, you know, the driver's the voice of the car. They've got all these sensors, but these sensors have no emotion. They don't really shout at you when they're not happy. They just give you the data. Where a driver can really articulate with his hands, his voice, his eyes, how important the fix is. And that tends to focus the mind of these engineers. So everything is necessary to bring success to the racetrack. And, all of these incredible bits of software and these incredible sensors are created by human beings. So at no point are we not in the loop other than when the sensors are actually doing their functioning role. But through discussion leads to development and solutions. And that, I think, is many examples of technology that's been developed on the racetrack that we take for granted in everyday life.
It is interesting, isn't it, that the decisions are taken, certainly strategically, based on hard facts and data rather than intuition. And very often, if someone snatches a good result out of the bag based on guesswork, just off the top of my head, thinking like the Daniel Kvyat's podium in Germany a couple of years back, based on an opportunistic timing of the pit stop, a lot of the strategists on rival pit walls will say, actually, that's bad strategy because that decision wasn't, it was guesswork and it was like a coin toss. It wasn't based on numbers. So I think it was the McLaren strategist said, you know, we could have brought either or both of our drivers in and got that podium, but at the time that was not the right thing to do based on the knowledge that we have. So we didn't. We opted to protect what we had. And to my mind, that's kind of fascinating, isn't it? That you've got human beings almost overriding themselves, haven't you?
Yeah, I think that's a thing that came through from, again, in the interview with Neil. He talked about, he gave those three wonderful examples of race strategies, which looked totally counterintuitive from a human perspective. You know, the David, your victory in Australia in 2003, where you and Timmy finished first and third, was a sort of an unorthodox strategy that he talked about. And, you know, also, I love the fact that he talked about the Ferrari making the decision to give Felipe Massa a five-place grid penalty at the United States Grand Prix in 2012 by breaking a seal on the gearbox so that Fernando would start from the better side of the grid and have a greater chance of getting on the podium. From a human perspective, those decisions wouldn't be easy. But when the data says, actually, if we do this for Fernando, he's more likely to get on the podium, which is what happened, that's what they end up creating the race strategy from. So it's all about people being given information that have helped them to make better, faster, better quality decisions.
Shall we circle back to the subject of safety quickly? Because I know, Mark, you've got a hard deadline before you go and wow some more clients, with no doubt with spoken word excerpts from your soon-to-be award-winning and best-selling book.
I'm going to have to live up to the billing that you've now given it. But anyway, thank you. I hope we get into double figures with the sales.
It's now kind of more or less a year since we witnessed probably the scariest accident in a very long time, involving Romain Grosjean in Bahrain, which underlined to me the fact that safety is always a work in progress, because all the circumstances that fed into that accident had existed. That wall that he hit hadn't just been put there. It was always there. And we were talking about a track that's 16, 17 years old. So, Christiana, I know you've worked with the FIA's commissions on safety. How do you actually go about predicting and mitigating against accidents like that happen in, you know, a location that's been the same way for ages?
So there are quite a few things. So I've been involved in the safety department with FIA from 2004 until 2016, actually. not just in F1, it's like the last few years of my consultancy for the FIA was actually in cross country and trying to increase the safety there, where you think it wouldn't be any problem because there is no barriers and it's all desert, but actually there are bigger problems in terms of safety. I would say lots has been done in terms of safety since 2004. We had lots of fantastic things introduced. I remember being at a dinner table and invented the marshalling system together with Charlie Whiting and Colin, because they needed that in the race control. And we started to introduce it in 2007. Drivers were not very happy. They had to interact with something in the car. So I think there is a lot of things. But that's actually giving us the bulk of data that we needed to try to prevent accidents. And again, it goes back to what the other says about data. We need a bulk of data on accident, on crashes, to try to understand how that can happen and how we can improve safety in the car and off the car. And because we acquired with the FIA Institute, we acquired that accident data, not just from F1, but from all series, as well GTs. There is quite a number of scenario, and I would say what we do is scenario analysis. So we take that what will happen if that happen, if in here what happen at which speed, what the barrier does, and the circuit department and the FIA technical department normally work together to try to put all the piece of the puzzle so that everything is really safe. But I always stress it that 100% safety in motorsport will never happen. Motorsports is still dangerous, and there are that one in a million times that something can go wrong and things can actually result in someone dying, unfortunately. So I think there is a lot that we have learned from Jules Bianchi crash, and a lot has been improved in the car and off the car. There is also a lot that we have learned from Grosjean crash fires. And that has been very good to showcase best practice on a number of levels. But there will be some more to do. I think the bulk has been done. There is just a few refinements to do. And I think the biggest challenge is actually to implement that in junior formula. And that is something that is already on the roadmap since 2016 from the FIA. But as you know, there are some cost constraints to introduce some of these safety measures into lower formula. So I would say motorsport is safer than it was in 2004 now. Can never be 100% safe. It's still motorsport is dangerous, as everybody knows. And the biggest challenge is actually to bring that best practice from F1 to any other formula up to like regional formulas or like your club's rally or anything like that.
Motorsport does seem to be better or getting better at learning the lessons of the past. For instance, to take a very high profile example, Ayrton Senna's death occurred at a corner where there had already been two very serious accidents in the preceding years with Nelson Piquet and Gerhard Berger. David, obviously Senna was irreplaceable, but you took his seat at Williams after his fatal accident. I mean, how did that experience affect your outlook as a young driver kind of making their way in Formula One?
Well, it was shocking, of course, because it was the first time that I had, other than in Formula 3, where Dutch driver Marcel Albers sadly lost his life at Thruxton. It was the second time that I'd ever faced the realities of motor racing being dangerous. Of course, I've raced since I was a little kid, so I've had bumps and shunts and bangs and you know, was aware of the dangers. But I think it's a little bit like everyday life. We don't wake up every day thinking it's potentially our last day, but potentially every day is our last day until it is actually our last day. So I think that there's a misperception that racing drivers are risk takers. My experience, and you know, I'm sure Christiana's experience of working with many, you know, either current or ex-drivers, is they're actually risk averse. They very much look at the science, look at what is possible. You know, how much downforce is this new wing going to give us? How much faster should that allow me to go through the corner? They don't tend to just go out and, you know, jump and then work out what to do thereafter. You know, so there's a great deal of science applied to clearly the design of the car, but that transfers itself to the way the drivers go about the risk analysis. And, you know, sadly, occasionally we do lose one of our colleagues. And that is always going to be the case. But I think that the, you know, FIA have done a brilliant job of setting a target, which I'm sure is zero tolerance, but with the acceptance that there will be incidents and accidents. And, you know, the advancement in technical regulations, you know, the very, very high standards that are set for the teams to reach in terms of crash structures, funnily enough, they reach them. Because if you don't challenge them, then they'll only do what's necessary. But they recognise the importance of it, and that filters down through the lower formulas. So it's fantastic to see.
I couldn't let you go without one final, slightly more solemn duty, because all three of you have worked with or for Williams, and we lost Sir Frank Williams, so maybe we could spend a few minutes kind of reflecting on Sir Frank Williams' contribution to Formula One as a whole and in the world of motor racing. I think it's a fantastic legacy of innovation and also passion, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I had the pleasure of working with Frank's team for a couple of years when I was running Cosworth, and we supplied engines to them. And I'd first met Frank actually a year after he had his car crash in the late 80s when I was working in the media. So I'd known him on and off for over 20 years, even by that time. But actually being a supplier, and particularly an engine supplier, tier one supplier, was an interesting experience. And I always remember on one occasion getting a phone call from his office to say, Frank would like a meeting. And I said, well, I'll just look at my diary. And they said, no, today. He'd like a meeting today. And I said, okay, well, I could be over at Grove by, you know, lunchtime. And they said, no, he's coming to you. He'll be with you in 90 minutes. And I'm thinking, bearing in mind he's a tetraplegic and it takes several hours for him to get ready, he obviously that morning woke up and said, I'm going to Cosworth to, I want to know what's going on with the engine. And he came over and he made this visit. And it was, you know, he spent about 4 hours with us. And I don't mind admitting, I sat there looking at him thinking, you know, this is a moment that I need to lock away where I've got this guy sitting in front of me who has forgotten more than any of us will ever learn about what it's like to run a Formula One business and be competitive. So that competitive instinct was still there, and that's only just over a decade ago. He was in his late 60s, and so I think for all of us who have ever interacted with him, you never came away with anything other than a deep impression of his competitive instinct and his commitment to the task in hand.
If I can jump in, actually, I'm just going to spin the computer around, because Sir Frank would have loved the fact that we have a racer in the house, Daniel Ricciardo, making a little...
What's going on?
A little jump into the office here.
Lucky I got changed.
Yeah, normally racing drivers take a relaxed approach to life, but we're just talking about Sir Frank Williams. And the reason to highlight the fact that you've just bound into the office is Frank loved racers. He loved people that get stuck in. And I think that we can agree Daniel's one of the all-time late breakers. He's just flexing his muscles out of camera shot here.
But, you surely can't see that under the hoodie that's about eight sizes too big for him.
He does have a hoodie.
Comfort clothing.
Comfort clothing. Yeah, he likes to have that wow factor when he undresses, so he hides everything until the last moment.
Oh, please.
In all seriousness and in conscience of time, Frank gave young men and women their opportunities. If you were good enough, you were old enough. If you were good enough, you were the right person. And his legacy of supporting young talent is something that I will always be appreciative for. And again, as I've just highlighted there, he was a racer. He didn't mind if you crashed having a go, but he minded if you didn't have a go and didn't get the result.
I would have to agree with David as well in terms of engineering. I think it was very much like, if you think that is the right way to go, let's do that solution and see if it works. And if it doesn't work, you have tried. And I think one of the things that I really admired about him is the time that he had to give to other people. He had a lot of time for everybody. It's like he would have, 7 o'clock, he would have been there with his wheelchair, just going around the office and just speaking with everybody and asking. And he could remember everything. He could remember where your husband was from and what he was doing and how many kids you had. And it was absolutely amazing with everybody in the office. Didn't really matter where you were, like if you were a senior person or if you were a junior. He just had a lot of time for everybody. And it was very much part of making you feel like part of the family. And that's what I would always remember about my time at Williams.
It was an incredible life. Well, thank you for taking the time to share your memories of Sir Frank Williams. Thank you for taking part in this podcast. Sadly, we have to go before Mark Gallagher turns into a pumpkin or a glass slipper or something. Just time to say thanks to all my guests, Mark Gallagher, Christiane Apache, Dr. Christiane Apache, David Coulthard, and of course the unmissable cameo appearance of Daniel Ricciardo. Thank you very much.